You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Okay. Is that okay? All okay? Yeah? Happy Cyber Monday, everyone. Hope Thanksgiving was great and you spent all the time working on assignment two. So remember that's due tomorrow. And remember there's an online submission form rather than emailing it to the TA, which proved to be not scalable last time we tried that. So basically this week I kind of want to wrap things up by revisiting everything from the previous 9 weeks and seeing how do these topics change once we add a temporal dimension to them or something like that. So how can we do regression, classification, social networks, whatever we like, once temporal data gets into the mix. So this week at least I'm going to cover the first 4 weeks of class, so regression, classification, dimensionality reduction, recommender systems, and see how these things kind of change once we have temporally evolving data, or once the thing we're trying to predict is, say, the next value in a time series. I couldn't actually think of anything to cover on temporal dimensionality reduction. If you have any ideas, do let me know. All I could come up with was something like studying Fourier series, or that didn't seem like anything we want to cover in week 10. Or really what my course is about. So this week at least we'll just have regression, classification, and recommender systems. I used to have about 20 minutes on temporal graphical models, which I no longer have because we replaced graphical models on that online advertising. So instead I think I'll just talk about some of my own research on temporal recommender systems, as well as the main part of the lecture, which is results from Karen. Essentially this is a case study of what actually won the Netflix prize. So we talked about the Netflix prize a bunch when we looked at recommender systems in week 4. What actually got the best solution was sort of very carefully incorporating the temporal dynamics that actually take place on Netflix into a good model. So I'll cover that at length. All right, so very quick sort of recap. What did we do back in week 1 so long ago? We just built models for linear regression. So we're building features based on, say, user demographics and properties of items, and we'd like to come up with linear predictors that would say, are each of our features positively or negatively correlated with the real valued output variable? That was our sort of very standard linear regression style setup. Also in week 1, we looked at ideas like, this is where we saw overfitting and the sort of idea of a regularization pipeline. So how can you measure whether a model is complicated or simple? And then how can you train a model to favor simplicity over complexity? And then how can you build a pipeline that's going to say how much should you favor simplicity versus complexity? And how should you choose which model is the best in the sense that it's most likely to perform well when applied to new held out data? We also saw this idea of, you know, why is the mean squared error justified as a way of evaluating different models? So, you know, why use the mean squared error rather than the mean absolute error or something like that? And this kind of is where we introduced this idea of a probabilistic model. So the mean squared error was kind of motivated by this idea that, okay, there could be some model that's generating noise on top of our predictions. And if we thought, okay, noise is Gaussian, then what's the probability that we would observe this sequence of deviations from our predicted values under a Gaussian noise model? If we want to maximize that probability, we show that's equivalent to minimizing the MSE. So seems all a bit obscure now, but this is what really gave us this basic idea of saying, can we associate probabilities with the outcomes of our model? And if we can associate probabilities with them, then we have this very general purpose framework to do learning and optimization where we can just say, I'd like to maximize the likelihood. Can I choose the parameters such that the likelihood is maximized? Very flexible class of models. So today, we'll revisit this in a very simple sense, which is just to say, I'd like to continue to do real value prediction, but the value I'd like to predict is going to be the next value in a sequence. So it could be, I want to predict whether a stock's going to go up or down, whether what the weather's going to be tomorrow, how much website traffic I'm going to get tomorrow, whatever you like. So you'd like to predict the next event in some real valued time series. For classification, I actually don't have too much to say about temporal classification. I'll just give one very simple example. You know, this was sort of extending everything we saw in week one, but rather than having a real valued output, we'd have binary outputs or categorical outputs. So what's in an image? Will you purchase something, yes or no? Will you click on an ad? So yeah, this was like an extension of our linear models. We're trying to say, are features positively or negatively associated with a label? In this case, the label's just going to be true or false. And we saw three different ways of doing that. We saw naive Bayes, we saw logistic regression, we saw SPMs, which are just different assumptions about how features and parameters interact with each other, and different assumptions about what makes a model good or bad. And that's also when we looked at different ways of evaluating classifiers. So all I'm going to cover in terms of temporal classification is going to be simple sort of nearest neighbor classification. So nearest neighbor was the sort of parameter-free type of model where you're not trying to fit any parameters like this, you're just trying to come up with a similarity function. So given some label data set, maybe you have time sequence series associated with patients who, like medical records of patients who exhibit or do not exhibit a particular condition, and then to say whether a new patient has the condition or not, all I would have to do is say, who is the most similar patient amongst those they already have labeled? And then if the most similar patient has a condition, I'll predict they have the condition as well. So all that requires us to do is come up with a similarity function between time series. That's about all I'll say about temporal classification. Very simple model. Dimensionality reduction, yeah, I don't have much to say about temporal dimensionality reduction today, but quick recap anyway. I mean, we looked at PCA, which is sort of this very compression-oriented approach to finding low-dimensional structure in data. And in the case of PCA, generally in high-dimensional features, right? So you're given some high-dimensional data, and you assume it approximately lies along some low-dimensional manifold. In this case, low-dimensional manifold is going to be a line rather than a plane. So we'd like to say, can I project or compress this data to lie along a line such that I will lose as little information as possible by doing so in kind of the mean squared error sense? Or if you had very, very high dimensional data, can I come up with some hyperplane so that if I project onto that hyperplane, I would lose as little information as possible? And PCA gave us a nice automated way of doing that such that the MSE was minimized, and then it often ended up with sort of nice interpretable low-dimensional structure in our data that we could look at. For instance, when we applied it to these image patches, we sort of said, yeah, maybe a 3x3 color image patch is a 27-dimensional structure, but it can be pretty much described in terms of how bright is the image, how blue and green is the image, what are its horizontal and vertical gradients, and then what are the horizontal, vertical, and diagonal lines. So that would be like an 8-dimensional representation of an image, and that's pretty much going to capture what all realistic images look like. So it's kind of a cheap and cheerful compression algorithm for images that sort of captures how real images behave. Then we saw community detection, which is doing the same thing, but for networks or adjacency matrices rather than features. So it's still kind of making an analogy to compression, where we're trying to recover this adjacency matrix as accurately as possible using as little space as possible. And we noticed that we could kind of do this using communities. We could say, let's find a bunch of communities in this graph such that two nodes that belong to the same community will behave similarly in terms of how they form or receive edges from other nodes. And then rather than having to write down the whole adjacency matrix, we could just write down the set of community memberships, which is very low dimensional, in addition to the sort of interactions between the communities, so like a adjacency matrix between communities or something like that, if you like. And yeah, like I said, I don't actually have much to say about these in terms of time series progression, although we will look at temporal evolution of networks, at least, on Wednesday. So what I do have a lot to say about is temporal recommender systems. So recommender systems, I guess these are a lot of fun. They're something I actually do a lot of my own research on. I guess a lot of people are doing recommender systems of some kind for assignment 2, and it's also what we did for assignment 1. We built recommender systems like this, where we're trying to find similarity or compatibility between users and items. It's a kind of dimensionality reduction, right? Where This would be the low-dimensional structure that exists in the matrix of ratings that users gave to items. And we're going to say this has low-dimensional structure in the sense that we can find a few dimensions, like how much do I care about special effects or how much do I care about action, and correspondingly, how much does the movie exhibit those things, and then the compatibility or the inner product is going to be predictive of the rating. That's essentially what we saw in week four. We also briefly touched upon these things like the different rating distributions of products and ideas like implicit feedback. So even the very fact that you're choosing to rate something tells us a lot about what your rating is likely to be. You don't rate things independently of your rating, in other words. So the very fact that you chose to write a review of a $25,000 watch says that you probably loved it or hated it, rather than you thought it was just okay. That's kind of what we covered in week four. We covered these compatibility-based models of ratings, and we covered this idea of implicit feedback, which is also useful for the Netflix prize. And we sort of saw which of these things were useful at reducing the mean squared error on the Netflix data set, in terms of the history of how the Netflix prize evolved. Really, we saw, though, only the top left part of this plot, which is how much did the sort of plain SVD model work, how much did it help to add bias terms, how much did these implicit feedback terms add. That's as far as we got in week four. Really, what sort of killed the Netflix prize was a good high-fidelity model of temporal evolution. And kind of the surprising result that I'll show later is you're better off throwing away all this compatibility stuff and just handling temporal evolution than you would be just handling compatibility and none of the temporal stuff. So even a very simple model of temporal dynamics turns out to be much, much more effective than these very complicated high-dimensional models of compatibility. Okay, so that's the recap. Onto some new stuff. So regression for sequences. I mean, you remember our basic regression setup where we're trying to infer the function that generated the labels given the data. So let's just try and do the same thing for a sequence of real-valued events. So you have just some events. These are a bunch of real numbers, x1 through xm, is m-dimensional time series. So I don't know, it could be stock values for some stock, it could be the amount of website traffic you had, it could be the ratings that one particular user gave over time, and you'd like to predict, okay, what's their next rating or what's their current mood based on the things they've been rating recently. It could be the weather, I don't know, could be whatever you like. And our goal is going to be to predict the next value given all of the previous values. So we want to come up with x, so f, it takes x1 to xm, and it sort of predicts xm plus 1. All right, that's the kind of regression we'd like to do. So what's the simplest way? We could just do a sliding window. I'm sure people have done sliding windows in some kind of stats class where they make you do plots. I don't know. It's pretty simple. We'll just take some fixed window size k. We'll take the previous value, the second previous value. This is meant to be a prediction of xm plus 1. The third previous value all the way up to the kth previous value, so plus 1, I think. I always get my indices off by 1 here, but this should be a sequence of length k, and then you'll just take the average of these things. So sum k equals 0 to k minus 1 of x m minus k on k. All right, that's a sliding window, right? Nothing too deep there. The second thing you should remember about sliding windows is that you can compute the next value very efficiently by sort of the simplest dynamic program we've ever seen. So if you tried to do this naively, it would take O of m times k, because to compute this value here, where adding up k values, and we're doing this for every single point in our sequence, 1 through m, so to predict our entire stock market trend or whatever. But we can just observe that the next computation is very similar to the previous computation. So adding up the previous k values, we're going to look at the next set of k values. All I've got to do is peel off the oldest one, add on the newest one. So really just two operations rather than k. So this is going to look like f x1 up to xm. I've got to add the newest value, and I've got to subtract the oldest value, which is xm minus k plus 1, I suppose. And yeah, I've got to kind of gonna normalize it correctly. Okay, that's a sliding window. That's how you compute one efficiently. And that's going to take m plus k operations rather than m times k operations, which is pretty critical if you're actually applying it to any large data set. So my gift to you is some code to do that. So always, there's a few assignment twos with a plot that looks like this. It's not very useful. So this is the temporal evolution of beer ratings in that sort of 1.5 million rating data set. So what happened? Did ratings go up? Did they go down? Are they periodic? Who knows? So this kind of scatter plot is not very useful. Maybe the only thing I can tell here is that there are more ratings than there were to begin with, but not much else. So very simple sliding window gives you much nicer high-level analysis of the data. So there's still, 24 plus 7.5 hours to make your plots look like this rather than this if you haven't already. And the code is there for you. So I think this is much more useful, right? You can kind of see this is just a 10,000 rating long sliding window. And you can easily see sort of the long-term temporal trends. The ratings kind of got higher or something. There was some sort of dark age of beer advocate, and then ratings kind of went up, and then they went back down a little bit. And you can also see things like seasonal effects. So each of these spikes is actually 1 year apart, basically. So this is kind of the zoomed-out view of that plot I gave, I guess, back in week one, where we were just saying ratings tend to, I forget which direction they went, ratings tend to be lowest in June or something like that, and then they go back up towards New Year. So you can see both of those things. You can see the periodic and the long-term trends just by running a sliding window on it. Okay, so that's sliding windows. We can get a little bit more sophisticated. We can say, well, maybe I want to weight more recent events higher than less recent ones. So the previous value should be given more weight than the value k positions ago. And maybe it should be given linearly more weight. So I would take previous value plus the second previous value plus all the way down to the last value is xm minus k plus 1. Add to the second last value, xm minus k plus 2. And I'll say I want those to decrease in weight the further we go down. So maybe the oldest is worth 1, the second oldest is worth 2, the second newest is, or the newest is worth, then going to be k, and the second newest is going to be worth k minus 1. Sorry, that's drawn a bit ugly, but you get the idea. Then we have to normalize that correctly, because we're not just dividing by k anymore. We're dividing by k times this, k minus 1 times this, k minus 2 times this, all the way down to 2 times this and 1 times this. So we've got to divide this whole expression by 1 plus 2 plus so on up to k, which looks like sum of k equals 0 to k minus 1, k minus k, xk divided by k KH used 2, which is this expression here. All right, that's our linearly decaying version of a sliding window that just says more recent points are more important than less recent ones. And I won't bore you with the details, but there's like an equivalent dynamic programming solution to compute this. You have some triangle, you have the next triangle, so you sort of shave off the sum of all of the individual points to move the triangle along by one position. I don't know if all this makes any sense, but you can do a little bit of manipulation and convince yourself that this can also be done in O of M plus K. Third solution, let's just, rather than doing linearly decaying and take only the previous K values, let's just do exponential decay. Yeah? It's highly likely. So this should be XM minus K, right? XM minus K. Maybe? Everything's probably off by one as well. Deal with it. But yeah, there should be K values there. The most important should have value K, the least important should have value 1. And they should be in decreasing order of recency. Okay, this one is easier to write down, so I shouldn't mess it up. We can just have a simple exponentially decaying rule rather than this sort of fixed linear schedule. So our prediction for x2, say, we just say, well, it's equal to x1. That's our sort of basis. And then our rule for the next value would be to say, let's take our previous prediction, our previous value, sorry. We'll give that a weight alpha, and we'll give the rest of the weight to our previous prediction. Okay, and this is going to basically mean that rather than just looking at the last k values, we look at all of the previous values. They just get exponentially less important every step we go through. So I think I can give a quick picture to show what the difference is between these things, really. All I'm saying here, in all of these cases, is that my prediction of the next value is equal to some weight times the previous value plus some weight times the second previous value plus so on and so forth until forever or until some fixed length k. That's what all these models are doing. They're just applying a different weight to each of the previous observations. So method 1, my regular old sliding window, would just say that okay, you have k here, and you have theta k here, and you have capital K here. Then my function theta just looks like that. Yeah? Method 2 is just a different fixed schedule. Which would look like that. And method 3 would be kind of an exponentially decaying schedule. Well, it goes on forever. And it would look like that. So it wouldn't go below 0. So it's just 3 different ways of manually designing some decaying function which says previous values get less important over time. Either they stop being important after exactly k positions, or they gradually become less important. So, yeah, I mean, this is a data mining or a machine learning class, so can't we do better than coming up with some arbitrary fixed schedule that we just designed off the top of our heads? And in particular, how can we handle things like periodicity, which these models don't? They say recency is important for prediction, but they don't say, well, my website traffic is actually most similar to my website traffic 7 days ago, rather than my website traffic yesterday. Because, I don't know, we're on a business website, people tend to behave the same every Tuesday. So, yeah, why don't we apply supervised learning rather than the sort of unsupervised idea to this same task. So I've said that my models look like this. They all look like theta times a set of previous values. Or let's say it's a fixed size, so x minus m minus k plus 1. So I want to just do regular regression and treat this whole thing as a k-dimensional feature vector. And then we can fit this using our good old mean squared error and say I want sum over m equals 1 to however many data points I have, the actual value minus my prediction. Yeah, so regular ordinary least squares with a k-dimensional feature vector. Nothing we couldn't have done since week one, right? And that's going to be pretty much the same as these previous models, except that I'm going to learn my weights from data. So you can imagine getting a model that looks something like this, where this is like, I don't know, some time series progression of website traffic, and here's the parameter associated with yesterday, here's the parameter associated with the day before. So I don't know, maybe yesterday is a slightly good indicator. That's a mess. And there's 2 days ago, 3 days ago, 4 days ago, 5 days ago, 6 days ago, 7 days ago. And then you can learn, yeah, I mean, recency counts for something. Yesterday's traffic is a pretty good indicator of tomorrow's traffic. But the real indicator was how traffic was 1 week ago. So this kind of simple model can learn not just that recency is important, but also periodic effects are important. As long as you make your features or your bins or whatever go back far enough, you can then easily learn, okay, there's some amount of recency, some amount of weekly periodicity, some amount of yearly periodicity, some amount of monthly periodicity or something like that. So it's a very simple way of learning the periodic structure in your data just using very simple linear regression. Yeah, so fit it using regular least squares. This whole procedure is just called autoregression, so trying to predict a value in a sequence given the previous values. And then, yeah, you can get all kinds of realistic behavior. The fitting procedure is kind of agnostic to what ought to happen in the data. It's going to learn the weights automatically, such that you can find periodic effects. Okay? And that's all I wanted to say about regression. I'll never talk about it again. Make sense? So I think that's at least something that many of you can probably incorporate into making some nice plots by tomorrow, if nothing more. So I don't have too much to say about sequence data. I think I can run through this much fairly quickly. So we want to predict binary or categorical outcomes. So I'll just quickly run through the simplest case of classifier that we've come up with, which is like a nearest neighbor classifier. You've got a bunch of positively and negatively labeled training instances, and you just like to come up with a good similarity function that says, what's the most similar training instance, or what are the most k-similar training instances with known labels, and then the labels of my new instance is going to be whatever the labels were, the most similar instances. So let's just apply nearest neighbors to time series. Hopefully everyone remembers this algorithm or some variant of it. So the edit distance algorithm or the longest common subsequence algorithm. Yeah, I guess I won't really spend too much time on it. So all you're doing is taking some number of columns, and you want to match it up to the same number of rows, or you want to store this table which says what is the edit distance or what is the longest common subsequence between that subset of the two sequences. So nothing has anything in common with the empty string. These strings don't match in the first position, but they do match in the second position if we were to delete the first value from the first sequence and then match the second value in the first value. Yeah, whatever. I'm assuming you kind of a memory stores about what's going on here, and then you fill in this table until you are done, and then that's going to be the longest common subsequence, and then you can also store the sequence of additions and deletions that got you there. What's important, though, is this is just a nice similarity measure between two sequences. So we can use that for the straightforward nearest neighbor classification of time series. So there's some pseudocode for that. I think the pseudocode is actually slightly different. This is edit distance rather than longest common subsequence, but same thing for nearest neighbors, right? You can take largest common subsequence or smallest edit distance as your way of doing nearest neighbor classification. Not too much going on there, I guess. It's just a simple way of applying nearest neighbors to time series. This is called dynamic time warping. So if you had two speech signals, one of which was sort of sped up and the other of which was slowed down, you could use a simple classifier like this to learn that, yeah, even though they don't match exactly, if you delete points from one of them, it looks pretty much like the other one in sort of a nearest neighbor sense, or has a very long common subsequence with the other one. Okay, so actually we won't come back to time series classification with graphical models. We will move straight on to recommender systems, which I think are much more fun. So really this is just a big case study of what actually won the Netflix Prize. So if you remember your Netflix Prize history, it was actually some horrid kind of Frankenstein solution where a bunch of teams combined their own horrid Frankenstein solutions into who knows what, some giant monolith. But this is kind of the best single-team solution before everything got combined and messed up. So this is based on this paper by Karen, or the Netflix guy, as I called him, who was the head of the team that was the best single-team solution to the Netflix Prize before everyone got combined. It's described in a very nice article called Collaborative Filtering with Temporal Dynamics, which is linked in a minute. Remembering back to week 4 or 5, we kind of saw that the essence of all recommender systems, or a system that's capable of personalizing content to users, is going to be a system that learns some notion of compatibility between users and items. So we'd like to learn to what extent is each user attracted to some low-dimensional property of a movie, like special effects or action, and to what extent does each of our movies exhibit those properties. We saw some pretty simple ways based on SVD or some gradient descent approximation of SVD that would give us these low-dimensional factors automatically, just given this sort of partially observed matrix of the ratings that users gave to items. Okay, that's looked something like this. This should all be very familiar to everyone from assignment one. Forget the optimization procedure, but the form of the model is the important part. You have the offset, the user and item bias terms, which basically say is the user generous and is the item good, and these low-dimensional factors which describe compatibility between the two. And what's important now is to say, well, this model just depends on the user and the item, but it doesn't depend on the timestamp at all. And we have some evidence from a few weeks ago that there are temporal dynamics going on in this data set. So we saw it's one case, which is just the timestamp of the rating from the oldest to the newest, and the average rating for some bucketed number of ratings over time, and there's this sort of abrupt change. Remember why? Yeah, some sort of UI thing that Netflix did. I forget exactly what. They just changed the wording, I think, and people started rating things very differently immediately after that. It's a kind of temporal dynamic. We should capture this in a good model. We don't just want to ignore these old values, their data, but we should sort of treat them differently. We'd like to figure out what's the shape of this curve so that we can rescale the data so that we're not going to be negatively impacted by whatever went on this date. The second kind of dynamic was this idea that people tend to give higher ratings to older movies. This is not an old movie in terms of when its release date is. It's an old movie in terms of how many days ago from the release date is it today. I don't know if the distinction makes any sense there. But basically it's saying, as the movie gets older, as it's been on Netflix longer, in other words, people will tend to give it a higher rating. So I don't know what happens. It tends to gradually gain cult status or something like that, or maybe it's even something more simple, like if you choose to review an older movie on Netflix, it means you sort it out because you already thought you would enjoy it, and that just means that older movies tend to be biased towards higher ratings. Whatever. Something's going on that causes people to rate older movies higher. It's a temporal dynamic that we should consider. We should consider the delta between the rating date and the movie's first rating date as somehow being predictive of the rating. Okay, so what did Crane actually do in this very nice paper? Well, they did a lot of things. Let's start with the very, very simplest model, which just has bias terms. Okay, so there's no compatibility between the user and the item. This is kind of this too naive model that we started off with, but we're adding temporal dynamics to it. So we're going to say that users change over time and items change over time. And I guess we gave some high-level intuition as to how items and users change over time. Like in the previous plot, it's something like a long-term gradual change where movies just get better and sort of time periods that are several months long. What happens for users? Well, human beings are a bit more fickle. So maybe you suddenly like a new genre of movies, or I don't know, maybe someone else is using your Netflix account. Maybe you just have a really bad or a really good day where you just rate everything 5 stars regardless of whether you liked it or not. So maybe we need to handle this kind of bursty or short-lived behavior if we want to capture users. So I don't know if this is a rule or anything. It's more like what makes sense for Netflix in particular. And I think really this solution that I'm talking about, a lot of stuff is very, 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 very Netflix specific. So it's a nice case study in how some people were able to hammer away at one particular data set and really uncover the deep characteristics of that data set. As you'll see, not everything is going to generalize to every other rating data set you're going to see. But, you know, there were $1 million in it, so some amount of overfitting is fairly understandable, isn't it? I'll overfit for $1 million too. So what can we do with just temporal biases? First thing you could do is just split your data into bins or something like that. So this is just at the item level for the moment. So let's just say, let's make 10-week-long bins, and people could rate an item differently depending on which bin the rating was given in. So this is already capable of, I don't know, if you imagine, what, 10 weeks, 70 days, or a bin maybe this wide, you could capture sort of changes at that level of granularity in terms of the way people rate items. So that's a pretty simple model for long-term gradual temporal drift at the level of items. I say simple. 30 bins is, and we're indexing this parameter by item and bin, that's 30 extra parameters per item. So it's already something that might not work for every data set. Netflix, it was okay. They had hundreds and hundreds of ratings for every single movie. If you tried to do this with the Amazon data that I gave you, it wouldn't work at all. I think the average number of ratings per item in that data set was like 4, 5. So you probably couldn't even fit 2 extra bins. You've got to be very, very, very careful about how many parameters you throw in. This is a really dense data set. They didn't have to be so careful. So you get the idea about some of this being a bit Netflix specific. That's long-term gradual drift. They could also capture periodic drift in a very similar way. This is like 10 weeks throughout all of time, and this is a way of saying, okay, for each item, let's have a parameter for Monday, a parameter for Tuesday, a parameter for Wednesday, a parameter for Thursday, a parameter for Friday. Or, you know, you could have a parameter for spring, summer, autumn, winter. That's a very simple way of augmenting your bias terms to capture long-term drift and periodicity simultaneously. Okay, that's items, and that's like long-term drift. What can we do for users? So we're going to need some kind of periodic terms or some gradual ways that users change like we have here. We're also going to need things like bursty dynamics, because maybe a user just has a bad day, or maybe they suddenly change, or someone else is using their account or something like that. We're going to run into other problems, like we can't necessarily fit. I mean, these are not complicated models, but they're very expensive models in terms of the number of parameters we threw in. We can't necessarily fit models like this for users in the same way we could for items, because we mightn't have so many observations per user to do so. Okay, so first of all, the long-term dynamics. This is a very funny function, which is always fun to explain, that they use to model long-term dynamics at the level of users. So TU here is the mean rating date for a user. So if you order all of their, if you order the timestamps of all of their ratings, TU is the timestamp that falls in the middle. So this is going to be a negative number if it's newer than their mean rating date, and a positive number if it's newer than their mean rating date, and a negative number if it's older than their mean rating date. And then that is going to say how many days are we away from that mean rating date. We're going to take that to some power. I don't know. It's a function. So you can draw it. So this is, on the x-axis is t minus tu, and on the y-axis is going to be the value dev u of t, and what's our exponent? If x is equal to 1, this would look like a straight line, right? It would say people rate things more positively, or maybe they rate things more negatively over time. The rating just goes up linearly. If we had x equal to 2, it would look like a quadratic function on the right, and it would look like an upside-down quadratic function on the left. If you had x equal to 0.5, it would look like a square root function on the right and an upside-down square root function on the left. A bit odd, but, I mean, you can grasp the deep math here, right? It's something happens to the user around their mean rating date, which to me is a bit silly because no one even knows what their mean rating date is. It's just arbitrarily cut off whenever they stop collecting data. Who knows how much longer they're going to be on Netflix, but this is assuming some magic happens around the middle of your life up until the point the data was collected. So they fit this, and they found a parameter of 0.4, so roughly this kind of shape was good. Looks something like this, and they also fit some... There's a sign term for each user, which would allow this thing to be sort of flattened or stretched out or go the other way up, so everyone could get more negative rather than getting more positive. It's a very funny, very specific function. I think this is another case of things being a little too tuned to Netflix data. This is just my guess about why this thing happened to work so well. Well, yeah, there actually was some elbow shape around the middle of the lifetime of the data set, which pretty much followed this function. So this weird thing they came up with kind of worked. I strongly doubt it would work in any other data set, but I don't know. Some genius behind that. But what's certainly virtuous about this model, as kind of weird as it is we did some kind of high-level notion of users gradually changing over time, and we only needed one parameter per user to do so. So this exponent here, that's shared across the entire population. So all we needed for each user is this sign and scale term, much cheaper than our sort of item-level dynamics that we had so far. And that's going to fit some complicated function form. So I guess the moral of the story is, rather than maybe applying this to Netflix, is to say, given that you can't afford a lot of parameters, perhaps, then it's going to make a lot more sense to try and figure out what the actual shape of the function is, rather than trying to learn some sort of general form. But they also learn some general form too. So you can do it the more expensive way too if you can afford the parameters. So if you don't like this specific form of the function, we could learn a more general function by using some kind of splines and control points. And then it could take on any shape you like. This is very similar to using just bins like we did for items, except people are going to evolve smoothly between bins rather than abruptly like items did. This is a sort of complicated function, but actually not a lot is going on here. We're building in a bunch of control points with biases associated with them. So you have some curve that looks like this. We just have equally spaced time intervals for each user. Each of those is going to be associated with a parameter. So what do we have? We have TU1, TU2, all the way up to TUKU. And each of those is associated with a different bias term, which is that's our BUT4, right? You with me? Yeah? And then this weird form of the function here is just saying, rather than those being just simple bins and a step function, we're going to interpolate smoothly between them. So yeah, it's a nice generic form of a function. And to stop the number of parameters growing too terribly, they say that the number of control points for each user is going to grow slowly as a function of how many ratings that user has given. So using some magic number that they chose of n to the power of 1/4. So this function is, you're kind of going to use this function for a user who doesn't have a lot of data, and if you have a huge amount of ratings, then you can add a bunch of control points and fit a more general function for that user who's particularly active. Okay, so that's two fairly sophisticated ways of handling gradual drift at the level of users. The final thing to do is handle sudden change at the level of users, so people just being a bit fickle or sharing Netflix accounts or something. They did this in a very, very simple way. So all they did was add a per-day user bias term. It only matters if a user has, like, multiple ratings per day. So you can say at training time, well, I saw them rate things on the same day, so maybe at test time they're going to rate things similarly if it's the same day. This is going to add a huge number of parameters, of course, but if you regularize it properly, what's going to happen is that you'll just have only a few non-zero values of this term which said, okay, on that particular day, users rated things much higher or much lower than they normally would. So it's going to be able to basically capture those sparse selection of days where a user behaved particularly abnormally. And then, you know, they kind of pieced all of this nonsense together and came up with some combination of gradual and periodic and bursty user and item shift that all worked well together. So user deviations and item biases and bins and so on and so forth. What's kind of amazing, as I'll come back to in a minute, is that this bias-only model, which has no notion of compatibility between users and items, actually beat what Netflix was doing when the competition started. So it beat Netflix's Cinematch algorithm, whatever it was called. So just by handling temporal dynamics well, even though no notion of compatibility is there yet whatsoever, was enough to beat what Netflix is doing. And beat is maybe the wrong word, though. It beats it in terms of the MSE, which is what they were giving the $1 million on, but it's still pretty useless as a recommender, right? It can learn you're having a bad day. It's not very helpful to recommend you things. And yeah, it can learn temporally evolving item biases, which will say, yeah, you should recommend summer blockbusters during summer, but that's not very personalized, right? this model would still recommend the same thing for everyone at a particular point in time. So it's kind of useless as a recommender system, even though it happens to be very good at minimizing the MSE. So the next question is kind of how can you add temporally evolving latent factors into the model to get something that's good at minimizing the MSE, so it predicts ratings with high fidelity, but is also useful in terms of personalizing things to individual users. So this thing, I've got to get rid of this from the slide. It's just, they kept adding more parameters, never quite stopped. So actually the model had some additional per user scaling term of the item biases. So this is like, you know, you have movies getting more popular as they become classics, but each user can have a scaling term which would measure maybe how much they care about classicness or how much they're sensitive to that type of behavior. Anyway, moving on, how can we handle things like per factor temporal dynamics? What they did there was actually pretty simple. So they can have this notion of, again, you have your regular non-temporally evolving user preference toward factor K. They also have a factor-dependent drift term, so it's the same weird form of the function that they came up with. And then they can fit that and say, given a particular factor K, does your preference toward that factor increase or decrease over time, following, again, that same weird schedule. And they can also handle short-term dynamics in the same way they did for individual users. This is saying, okay, a user had a particularly bad or a particularly good day. This would say they had a short burst of time in which they were interested or uninterested in some particular factor. So maybe for a week-long period, they just really liked action movies and binge-watched them or something like that. Maybe this is the one that would be... I mean, this and this, they can handle binge-watching, and they can also handle someone else using the account or something like that pretty effectively, I think. Okay, so that's pretty much all of the tiny little bits and pieces they described in their in the sort of paper before all of these things got mixed up. And it was, at the end of the day, whatever this Frankenstein solution was, the moral of the story is that handling temporal dynamics really was what kind of killed the Netflix prize. And the surprising outcome is that temporal dynamics with only bias terms is sort of better than no temporal dynamics and the most sophisticated high-dimensional model, or, for that matter, whatever Netflix had at the time. The caveats here are it's very dependent on the setting. Many, if not most of these things, would not really work if you tried to transfer them to these like Amazon data sets, which are way, 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 way sparser, and you just can't afford to fit these very, very, very high-dimensional models, or they're using funny forms of the function, which are kind of tailored towards what was actually going on Netflix. Okay, so I have some minutes, so I think I'll talk about a bit of my own research on temporal recommender systems, which is a different kind of temporal model that's going to capture some notion like expertise rather than these sorts of gradual item drift and gradual user drift. So how does this look? So this is an idea I had when I first moved to the US and found everyone was drinking these horrible beers called IPAs. I guess some people here drink them, right? The IPA fans? One. Good. I'm glad to hear they're losing traction. So, if you don't know what an IPA is, these are these beers that have funny names like Optimus Prime and Red Hoptober. There's a new one called Palate Smasher, I should add there. They're basically just these undrinkably bitter beers that... I can't even taste anything after I drink them, but I asked the Americans why they like these beers so much, and they just would say, keep on drinking them. You'll eventually get it. And then this led me to this nice piece of folklore called the lupulin threshold shift. Lupulin is basically the ingredient that causes hops to be bitter. The story goes that if you expose yourself to enough lupulin, you gradually become accustomed to it, then you can no longer taste the lupulin, and then... you see past the bitterness to whatever the magical characteristics of these beers really is, and then you think it's better than anything else. Yeah? Maybe? Never happened to me, but that's what people say. So can we handle that in some kind of temporal recommender system? So at least for movies or something like that, we've seen a bunch of reasons why maybe people's perception towards movies would change over time. So why might it be that you liked Harry Potter, assuming you did, in 2004, but maybe didn't like it in 2014, 10 years later? So one reason might be you're a particularly special effects sensitive user. You like good special effects. They just got outdated in 2014, so you wouldn't have liked the movie in 2014, even though you did in 2004. Okay, that's kind of like our notion of the movie getting old, in this case in a negative way. Another reason, maybe you were just closer to being a child in 2004, maybe you've just outgrown Harry Potter by now. So you got old in that case. And in the third case, you know, maybe it's popular now, but won't be in 10 years' time. It could just be that the Harry Potter will no longer be the wizard du jour. Children will still like wizards, they'll like some other wizard, so Harry Potter will just fade from memory as time moves on. So this is kind of the product getting old, the user getting old, or the community getting old. These are three ways that perceptions of some product could change. I think in the last section we kind of covered two of these. So we saw how the product getting old, which is this reference I gave in the last section, that's a way that temporal drift at the level of items could impact people's behavior. And even this other case, like the UI suddenly changing, is basically saying, well, it was temporal drift at the level of the entire community. What we didn't quite see is this notion of a user getting old. So really, what happens when users acquire tastes or they acquire expertise? So something that wasn't in the Netflix data, and maybe wouldn't make much sense for the Netflix data, is how would the very act of watching more movies change your opinion of movies? I don't know if it makes sense for movies, but it makes sense for beers at least. No one liked their first beer, and I think most beer drinkers don't like their first IPA, but you expose yourself to it more and more and more, and that exposure is actually what causes your preferences to change. So how can we handle that notion of expertise? And that's going to be useful whenever you want to capture something like an acquired taste. So beer and wine is going to be perfect for doing this, not just because, yes, we think acquired tastes exist there, but also because it's this very dense data where you have each user reviewing something like an average of 50 to 100 beers, so you can really see how people's tastes systematically change over time as they review more and more and more things. So let's just try and fit this standard model, like we've always been doing, with an offset user and item biases and user and item low-dimensional factors, and see, can we make each of these things change as a function of time? We've seen a bunch of ways of doing that for Netflix data, so we kind of know how we would do that if we wanted to handle these two notions of temporal evolution. Could we come up with a version that works well for acquired tastes? So the kind of models we've seen so far, one would be just a simple model that takes each user's review timeline and would make a bunch of different bins for the whole time period. So here's your model for 1990 to 1995, your model for 95 to 2000, your model for 2000 to 2005. And this would just say, during each time period, there was a different preference at the level of the entire community that would cause people to evaluate things differently. This could handle something like a UI change, right? You could learn that during the first bin, ratings were low, and then suddenly in some bin, ratings changed, something like that. So this would be like community-level temporal dynamics, separate models for each time point. The other way that we've already seen would be something like this. We've seen it for items, I guess, rather than for users. But you could say, well, given the entire review timeline of the item, what matters is how long the item has been around. And that would say people like movies more as they become classics or something like that. So you have one model for movies that have just been released, one model for when the movie's been around for, this is the one that's just been released, one model after it's been around for a while, and one model as it gets older and older and older. that will be able to handle something like, I mean, that's roughly how they handled temporal evolution in terms of items getting older. The question is, can we do the same thing for users somehow and capture a notion of expertise that will say, here's one model for a user who's drinking their very first beer. What are they going to like then? And what are they going to like as they drink enough beers to eventually appreciate an IPA? So that's what we'd like to do. One more detail, of course, is that on a beer rating website, thankfully, you don't see a person as they drink their very first beer. Presumably, many people have consumed many beers before they review their first one. So everyone shows up with a different level of background experience, and you don't know quite how much experience they've gained up to today or how quickly they're acquiring experience. So that's something you'd also like to learn as well. You'd like to fit for each individual user. How quickly are they gaining experience? How much do they have to begin with? How much do they end with? And what are the different models for each experience level? So we kind of have two things that need fitting. We need to fit these, say, five models for different experience levels. These are kind of the most novice users and the most advanced users. There's one model for each user group. And secondly, we've got to fit for each user at each point in their review history, how experienced were they when they performed that review. So this is a complete review timeline for one user who reviewed eight things. In his first review, he was like level two beer reviewer, and eventually he'd reached level four by the time of the most recent review. So we've got those two things we need to fit. We need to fit our five models, which are kind of global things that say how do different people behave at different experience levels, and we need to say for each user, how do they progress through these models throughout time. And our assumption, which is going to hopefully mean this corresponds to something like expertise, is that expertise is something you gain monotonically. You only become more expert as you evaluate more and more and more things. So we're going to fit some monotonically increasing function for which there's a nice DP solution. Okay, so that's what the model looks like. We're not quite modeling things in terms of time, but we're modeling things in terms of this weird latent variable that we call expertise, which is a function of time. The more things you do, the more expert you become. And then we're fitting in the regular old way, where we're just trying to say, I need to come up with these parameters for each of my models, each of my five experience levels. And I'd also like to fit this latent variable, which says how expert was each user at each time point. Okay, so it's just the familiar kind of optimization procedure we normally deal with. First, imagine you knew all the expertise levels of every user when they reviewed everything. So then you can just fit your five models individually, or basically saying, let's fit the expertise level one model, the expertise level two model, using regular old gradient descent. And then given your new model, find which progression of expertise values would best model how the user progressed through those models over time, alternate the two until the thing converges. That gives you some pretty good notion of five different levels through which most users monotonically progress. And we'll just name those things expertise levels. Okay, so in terms of rating prediction, which is maybe not the most interesting part, this is better than state of the art. Maybe state of the art's a strong word. I mean, it's better than the sort of non-temporal models by some pretty decent percent on beer, wine, and movie data sets. More interestingly is what you can actually do with a model of expertise. One thing we found you can do is kind of predict who's going to eventually quit or remain in a beer website. So beer websites are pretty snooty places. If you don't agree with the most elite users, maybe you're going to get frustrated, or if you don't like IPAs in particular, maybe you'll get frustrated and want to quit. So you can actually kind of tell very early on in a person's reviews that if they're not gaining expertise quickly, they're more likely to be a user who will quit the website rather than stay active. Yeah? Well, you don't ever get it for training data. You're just fitting a sequence of latent variables. Expertise is just like a name you assign to them. You're just saying there exists some fixed number, in this case five levels, through which people systematically progress. So we're not finding expertise per se. We're saying we're finding a common behavioral pattern, a common behavioral trend that applies to all users as a function of how many beers they consume rather than, you know, their physical age or the the date of the review. And we'll just name that expertise. So expertise is whatever common property people acquire as they perform more actions. Yeah? So one thing you can do is predict who's going to stay or go. The more fun thing is to say, what do experts like and what do beginners like? So two nice trends we found here. This is a sort of complicated and tough to digest plot. On the x-axis is just saying how popular is the item overall, from the least popular to the most popular items in terms of their star ratings, versus how much is it preferred by experts or preferred by beginners. And there are two kind of high-level trends here. One is that there are kind of entire genres or subcategories of items that are almost always preferred by experts. So, yes, people who perform more actions or consume more beers always tend to prefer IPAs over people who have not, at least on average. And the opposite can be said of things like what's called an adjunct lager, like a Bud Light or something like that, is almost always preferred by beginners. The other nice property is you find this, and this is true of a lot of other data sets too, you find this sort of nice linear trends which actually say experts and beginners tend to like the same things. It's just beginners can't quite fully appreciate an IPA. I mean, yes, people who are on a beer website probably like IPA a little bit. They just don't like it quite as much as the experts would. So everyone likes IPA, experts really like IPA, and everyone hates Bud Light, but experts really hate Bud Light. I think that's probably a good point to leave it. So I'll let everyone get back to assignment two. And I'll be hanging around for a good amount of...
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.